Open your ears and crack some beers. You are listening to episode 33 of Retro Hangover.
And in that choreograph is episode 33 of the Retro Hangover Podcast with your co-host, Chris Copleen, that is me, and your host, Shane Golden Dick Dragon Chocobo Koski.
I feel like that's an improvement from last episode, so I'll take it. Also, I like that, you know, with zero context, that intro is going to be confusing as fuck.
I think because of this episode, if you know what that is, you will understand almost immediately. And we will get into that, I'm sure, in this episode, what that is alluding to.
Yes, indeed.
It's Shane's favorite thing. When we were playing this game, he let me know how much he enjoyed doing that.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, my secret is out.
In any case, a brief little break. If you're listening to this, it might be sooner, because we all have interesting lives and we're doing crazy things. So, Shane, how have you been doing? How have you been enjoying your, favorite video games, Annihilation, in the movie theater?
Let's see. Favorite game, Annihilation, movie theater. I feel like I'm missing a connection here. What are we talking about?
You have not seen the Doom Annihilation trailer.
Oh, yeah, no, actually, I haven't, but I feel like I know everything I need to know about it by just the fact that id Software's official Twitter account came out and was like, yo, this ain't our shit. So
it's bad. Just die. That's all I have to say. Just go away.
I don't get it, man. Like, how difficult is it to make a decent, like, Doom movie, you know? Like, they surprised us, or at least surprised me, but I think they surprised a lot of people with Doom in 2016, because that game was fucking awesome, and it was just the right kind of, you know, so almost tongue-in-cheek, like, over-the-top ultra-violence that you would expect, and it was great. So I kind of feel like, aren't we about due for a Doom movie that kind of follows that same, you know, sort of through line? Like, is it that hard? Like, I mean, as much as I liked, you know, The Rock telling people Semper Fi, motherfucker, and then jump punching them, and also that all the things were not from hell, but some sort of genetic mutation, because that was around the time that Resident Evil movies got really popular, so clearly we had to piggyback off that. But I mean, come on, man.
Yeah, it seems like today The Rock would be like the perfect dude to be Doom Guy. Just big, muscly, dumb dude. And I think The Rock could play that very well. I'm not saying he's a dumb dude. I'm just saying he could play it very well. And you give him a giant gun and you give him the big muscles, which he already has. And then you have him kill CGI demons. You don't really need any more plot than that.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, to be fair, you probably don't even need – they could save some money in the budget and just not hire such a high-profile actor either. I mean, if you wanted to stay true to the game, then just have the Doom guy be in his suit and helmet the whole time and you just don't know who he is.
So get Terry Crews.
I mean, sure. Why not? He was in Crackdown 3. We all know how that turned out.
I mean, it's phenomenal, of course, I think. Right?
No, it's bad.
Oh, sorry.
I still love Terry Crews, though. He's ridiculous.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
So in any case, Shane, what games have you been playing since our last recording?
Well, certainly not Final Fantasy IX. Ayo!
Cock munch.
Listen, man, you set that one up, okay? I couldn't help it. But honestly, I think it's been kind of mostly the same. I think I've taken a little hiatus from my return sojourn into Dark Souls, and instead I ended up picking up a couple of the Assassin's Creed titles because they were on sale this past week on Steam. And so I got, what did I get? I got Rogue and Origins. And so I installed Rogue and started playing that because everything I've heard about it is it's basically like Black Flag 1.5, but it's a little bit more succinct and it's a tighter experience, which I like, because as much as I like Black Flag, I never actually finished it because it just felt too long. And I kind of got bored. So, but I've been enjoying Rogue so far. So it's been fun getting back and swashbuckling on the high seas. But other than that, not too much lately. I've been pretty busy. But what about you? Anything fun and exciting?
I finally got around to playing the super expensive and rare game that I purchased like way back in October or November.
Is this the one that shall not be talked about?
Well, I'll just say it. Panzer Dragoon Saga. if you don't know anything about that game, just look it up and go to eBay and just type it in, and you'll understand how retarded I am. It's a great game, though. It's a lot of fun. It's relatively short. I've only been able to put in like 4 hours into it because I haven't really been playing a lot of video games. Went through military school this week, which is at a location that's almost an hour away from my house. So I've been doing a lot of transit time. So during the week, like, I come home, I don't really want to play video games. I just want to go to sleep. So I think I fired up Fantasy Zone for my TurboGrafx a couple times, just because it's a short, fun burst of gaming, an old arcade kind of coin-op experience. And RF is terrible. I wish that the TurboGrafx didn't have that output, because it is severely ruining my gaming experience. Also went to the arcade, like Retro Jax, I don't know the official name of it. It's like the arcade, the Retro Game Arcade Expo, I guess I'm going to call it, here in, oh, right, in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of fun. Just, you know, you pay, you know, your nominal fee to get in, which is $20. And then you're free to play as many games as you want to, because all the arcade games then in there were free play. And they had a console set up from all generations to include like the Vectrex and one of the Commodore systems. I don't think it wasn't the Commodore 64, but it was that one that was intended to be portable. You know, the one with a little CRTV installed in it, and it was tiny and ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't know which Commodore it was. I know it's a Commodore, but like, it was a really cool expo. There's old toys. There was a toy expo I didn't care for much, but the kids love old toys, and just tons and tons and tons of arcade games. Not all of them were in the best condition, but it was still a really, really fun time. And I was able to play a ton of retro games. I uploaded it to my Instagram, and it was, I guess I'm getting into Instagram now. I don't know why, because I don't want to be that guy. But I am being that guy.
I noticed that, yeah. You've joined the rest of us now.
I hate myself, but I'm doing what I can, I guess. But yeah, I'm off to the races again here in the future. I'm going to be traveling to South Carolina this week, and then the week after, I'm going to be going straight to Tennessee, so that's plenty of time for me to use my gaming laptop, and I'm assuming I'm just going to be playing a lot of Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, or you know, you could fire up some Resident Evil for no particular reason.
God, I need to do that.
It's just putting it out there, you know, whatever.
No, I've been wanting to play that anyway. Hopefully I can make some serious progress in Panzer Dragoon Saga this weekend, so I don't feel guilty while playing Resident Evil. I still don't know which system I want to play it on yet, if I want to play on the GameCube or the Saturn, because those are the two versions I have, so we'll see how that goes.
Oh, see, there you go. You can get that side covered, and I'll play the Steam version, and we can compare notes.
That's the remake, right? On the Steam version.
Yeah, it is. I think I actually want to say I think I technically own, because they released it for PC before also, and I'm almost sure about that. I could be totally wrong, but the one that I'm referring to, yeah, is the HD remake.
HD remake, even though it wasn't HD when they remade it, it's glorious.
Yeah, well, you know,
pick and choose. And yeah. I think the good news, I don't think there's any major gaming controversies since our last recording. Like, that's crazy.
Let me see. Since the last time, I don't think so. Unless I think those all kind of blew over for right now.
Yeah, Blizzard didn't fire any more people, did they? I don't think they have yet.
No, not yet.
It's pretty calm right now. Hooray, calm.
Yeah, I know, right? It's an unfortunate rarity, apparently.
Okay. So with that being said, since the world of gaming is boring right now.
Yes, this is a nightmare hellscape, so let's talk about something old.
Yes, exactly. Because gaming is positive, and let's stick with gaming, because when gaming isn't negative, other things are. So we have to look back on happier, more negative times. So what are we talking about this week, Shane?
Well, Chris, this week we are discussing arguably one of the most celebrated entries into the Final Fantasy cadre, as it were, at least from a couple different angles, but I'm sure that that's highly subjective. But we are talking about Final Fantasy IX.
Yes, which many people incorrectly say is the best Final Fantasy, but that's their opinion.
There you go. It took like 15 seconds and already.
And they are allowed to have their wrong opinion.
So on that note, Chris, why don't you give us a little brief history on Final Fantasy IX?
The world is a dark place. Castles and knights have been replaced by skyscrapers and emo edgelords. MTV rules your game space with beautiful CGI videos and edgy, dark commercials. Everything you have known about Final Fantasy is different. It's changed. Even the battle theme intro has forsaken its holy beat. Don't worry, in the year 2000, Square heard you. There was a massive wave of success following the release of Final Fantasy VII, with its campaign focusing heavily on its, at the time, beautiful CGI videos, pre-rendered backgrounds, and 3D character models, and post-modern setting. All of these were departures from the mostly medieval-based fantasy setting of Final Fantasy's past, and certainly a departure from the graphical style. Parties were smaller, it went from 4 or 5 to 3. The items your characters were equipped with were fewer, classes were non-existent, and customization was approaching PC, now Western-style, RPGs. This was certainly a boon for the mass market. The subsequent release of Final Fantasy VIII cemented these departures even further. It was clear the future of Final Fantasy would not be locked into a medieval setting, nor would any of the fundamental structures be guaranteed, even if it had a reputation for changing from game to game to begin with. Fans who had been with the series since the days of Nintendo cried out, wanting what they had come to love from their beloved series on modern hardware. They would not be denied. Beginning development in 1998, right after Final Fantasy VIII had completed its development, Final Fantasy IX, which initially began as a gaiden or side story in the main series, as Square felt they would alienate newer fans by going back to medieval setting, was hot on the trail. As development continued, Square decided that it would indeed be a numbered game, and released in Japan of July 2000. With the North American release being 4 months later, and Europe getting in February of the next year. With its throwback approach and distinct graphical style, in addition to the PS2 being right around the corner and Final Fantasy VIII being received poorly, because it was a bad game, Final Fantasy IX sold significantly fewer copies than its two predecessors, with a total of the PS1 copies coming in at around 5.5 million copies worldwide. While impressive on its own, Final Fantasy VII and VIII sold 10 and 8 million copies respectively. In fact, since Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy IX is the lowest-selling mainline-numbered game in the series other than 11, which was an online game released in a time before those kind of things were wholly mainstream. Despite this, series creator Hironobu Sakaguchi has stated that Final Fantasy IX is his favorite game in the series, and he believes it to be everything that Final Fantasy was to be as he imagined it. He even stated that it was a game that was to revisit all aspects of the original Final Fantasy universe. In addition, longtime series composer Nobuo Uematsu called the score that he created for the game the best he had ever created for the series. Even if the game had a mixed aspect upon release, the game has had a resurgence of nostalgia and consideration in a Wind Waker-type aspect. Ports have come to mobile, PC, and modern consoles to much applause. While Final Fantasy IX may have not received the fanfare that its contemporaries did at release from its fans, a modern following has certainly shown up to pay respects. And that is your brief history of Final Fantasy IX.
Thanks, Chris. So I actually like that you compared it to Wind Waker, because that's actually a good point. I know back in the day, everybody threw kind of a collective shit fit about the design of Wind Waker just because it was different. And then, you know, everybody kind of came back around to it later and they were like, but it's like the most kawaii Link. And then suddenly everyone liked it. But yeah, so I've got some things that I want to say about Final Fantasy IX.
Well, go ahead and start us off.
All right. So I'm just going to go ahead and say it anyway, but like full disclosure, I have not actually gone through and completed the entirety of the game. And I will say that there's a couple reasons for that. One is just time and real life gets in the way and that sucks. And then the other part is, and I think Chris could probably back me up on this, and I might have kind of given up right before it actually started getting going, but I feel like the game drags in the first, like, half.
Yes.
Honestly, there wasn't really a lot compelling me to continue forward. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. It's enjoyable enough, but it just takes forever to get where it's going. Which actually is a little bit of a segue into some of the, I guess some of the issues that I personally have with it. And this isn't necessarily a laundry list of me just bashing the game or whatever, because there are some high points that I do want to point out. But I will say that I'm definitely not a fan of how they implemented the battle sequences in this game. And I know it's a JRPG, so you're going to expect to get, you know, random battles, which I'm not a huge fan of to begin with. Any game from friggin' Final Fantasy to Pokemon, as soon as I can find something that allows me to avoid those, I like activate that immediately. But, mm-hmm. But that's not even the biggest problem for me anyway. It's just like the unskippable intro, like swooshing in cutscene every single time a random battle occurs. It's a few seconds like too long every time. And because of the frequency of random battles in FF9, you just get like really sick of seeing that. Like whenever you get into a new area, you see it once for the first time and you're like, oh, that's cool. I get a little like flyby of the environment. Yay. Neat. And then after that, it's just like, okay, I got to wait through this thing again.
Well, that's not all that I think is wrong with the battle system. And you're absolutely right. It takes way too long on initial load for the battles. I think the other thing is when you're fighting, the battle animations for a lot of the enemies just drag on. And you can make your input for one of your characters, because it has the ATB, right? The active time battle that you was established in Final Fantasy IV. But it gets to the point where it loads up in your character and you select their action. And then they're just kind of sitting around because you need to see the battle animation for the enemy. And that has to complete. And the battle animation is, it starts the animation, they make their action, and then there's the finality of the animation. And everything is just so kind of cumbersome because everything is so, there's such a feeling that they have to detail every little thing that's going on in the battle, especially with more special moves.
Yeah, and I wonder, if this was intentional, I'm assuming it is, but one thing that I noticed with the random encounters is like, you'll run into the same sets of enemies multiple times. And then it felt to me like almost every time, if you encountered the same enemy with the same party set up, somehow the turn order is always like just randomly different for no apparent reason.
I didn't notice that really at all. To be honest with you, it was mostly Zidane was always my fastest character, just because Zidane, and I, you know, he's OP as fuck. And then just everyone else kind of, it didn't matter, to be honest with you. Everyone else just kind of fell in line.
See, I don't know. I don't know if it was something I was doing wrong or what, but I felt like, if theoretically Zidane should have been the first one to go just about every time, based on his stats. And that totally did not happen. There would be times where just for some reason, one of the enemies would get to go first, which would then put you in that position that you were just talking about, where you kind of like get to go through and select your shit or whatever, but you still have to sit there and wait for the enemy to slog through its attack animation.
Hey, which roll for advantage, man.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what we need. We just need to implement 5e rules. But yeah, so I mean, there's that, and there's some other like minor quibbles, I guess. If we're talking about combat related stuff, I like the idea of, Zidane being able to steal items. It's part of his character. It makes sense. That's fine. But you very quickly realize that in major fights, mostly like boss battles or mini bosses or things like that, if you want to obtain good items and not necessarily missable items in every case, but obtaining powerful items perhaps before you would be able to just purchase them at a vendor or pick them up in a, you know, a chest somewhere later down the line, you kind of feel compelled to have to like artificially prolong a boss fight and just like heal the rest of the party to make sure that you don't die, just to let Zidane try to steal like 1,000 times and then fail, and then you get angry about it. And this is even with his skills equipped that are supposed to boost his steal rate.
And see, I don't know if I wholly agree with you on that one, because I discovered this more towards the end of the game. And when I was playing this game, I was actively in communication with Shane about a lot of the issues that we had with the game. And one of them was, of course, getting items, getting certain items, getting certain weapons, getting certain materials, and leveling up towards certain skills. And what I discovered is you get closer to the end of the game, these items come to you. So you're going to get these skills and you're going to get these items and you're going to get these weapons eventually. But it's more about you are able to get them earlier. And if you're the kind of player that tries to get them early, then you're going to be frustrated when you can't. And that's part of that. And for a lot of people who play RPGs, whether it's, you know, Western RPGs or JRPGs, that is just something you typically try to do, but it doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of a difference. So I can understand like, oh, I'm so frustrated that I can't get this weapon. And then you find out like maybe 20 minutes later, you're able to purchase it and it's not a big deal. And that could be either, oh, I was so silly for trying to get it, or it could be these developers are just trying to troll me.
I mean, I personally felt a little bit of the latter. But yeah, I mean, like, well, man, with like Zidane's skill, right, to be able to like scan an enemy and see what they're holding, it's like I would always do that at the beginning of a significant battle or whatever, so I could see, okay, is there any stuff I want to grab? So then, like, yeah, I guess maybe just the type of player that I am, I suppose.
Well, you and most people who play RPGs.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair assessment. That, you know, I see that and I'm like, oh shit, like they've got, you know, whatever, the fucking fire staff or whatever. I don't have that one yet. And so I'll sit there and that fight will take like three times as long than it probably should have, but I'm doing that purposefully to try to get this like RNG to kick in to allow Zidane to actually grab the item, which also, by the way, there's like a second layer of RNG in that anyway, because there's usually multiple items that a character's holding and it's kind of random as to which one you grab. So you might grab the friggin' Phoenix down first, and then you're like, oh, cool, I guess, and then fail at getting, like, the cool magical armor or whatever for, like, 15 more turns.
I need to get the thing. I need to get the thing. That's not the thing.
Yeah, man.
Defend, heal, defend, heal. It's compulsive, okay?
I can't.
No, absolutely it is. It is. It absolutely is.
I mean, okay, to throw them a bone, I will say that in a way it's actually kind of nice that those items do show up shortly thereafter most of the time, because then that way you don't feel like you've completely missed something, which also leads into one of my other points about this, but I think you wanted to say something, so go ahead.
No, I just had to continue on with your description of the game.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, yeah, no, that leads me into my next point, and this is not an FF9 specific thing. This is actually just endemic in JRPGs in general, or hell, RPGs in general now. Missable content. I fucking hate missable content. Like, I guess it's maybe something that's in there to try to, like, make you want to play the game again to get more longevity out of it, but I can tell you what, I am not 14 anymore and have a shitload of disposable time, so if I'm gonna sink 80 hours into some epic RPG, you can bet your ass I am not gonna go back and do that a second time around. And
this is one of the things that, like, I had a conversation with you about while we were playing this game, because this stems from a conversation that we had about from Final Fantasy VII, right? When we were debating, we've had this debate a lot of the times that my point is games that were made during the PlayStation era, much until maybe mid PlayStation 2 era, were designs with the idea that you are going to buy a strategy guide. Yeah. So there are items that are easy to miss and you cannot get back. And there are certain things that you can only do one time in the game and you can never do them again. And they may have an item that you really want. And Final Fantasy IX is very guilty of this.
Oh my God, dude. Okay, wait. That reminds me of something. I need to vent this. All right.
Go. Do it.
I told you, I think I messaged you when this happened and I was pissed at the time, but it's relatively early on in the game, but you end up finding a spot where it turns out that there is there's a ledge inside of a building with a chest on the other end, right?
It's in Bermacia.
So, yeah, it's in Bermacia, and you go and you're like, oh, okay, well, this looks fine. And actually takes a little bit to even get to that ledge that leads to it in the first place. You have to kind of wind your way through a couple connecting adjacent buildings, right?
Right.
So in my mind, I'm like, okay, this seems like the end of this. There's no other surprises. Like, I had to kind of wind my way around to get to this chest. I'm just going to go grab it. Well, so playing this game on a PS2, it has, of course, analog sticks, which the original PlayStation, the game that this was originally made for, did not have. So part of the addition to that, well, at least not originally, but the addition to that was that, like, you can either walk around at normal walking pace with just your D-pad, or you can just run all the time by using the left stick. So I, of course, just try to run everywhere because ain't nobody got time to be walking at a leisurely pace in a JRPG.
And who doesn't run anyway?
Right. So I'm like, all right, I'm just running. So I go and run, and the fucking thing falls out from under me, and I drop off the ledge, and the chest is now 100% inaccessible. And I went and immediately grabbed my phone, and I was like, what the fuck is this shit? I went and looked it up, and they're like, yeah, so that ledge is triggered to fall and then make the chest completely inaccessible for the rest of the game if the character runs to it. But if you walk, you can get to it fine because you are treading lightly and it does not cause it to collapse, which was around the time where that was like one of several instances where I just wanted to say, all right, well, fuck this game and take the disc out of the PlayStation and call it a day. But it's those kind of things that piss me off. There should always be a way to come back to an area later on in a game to find things that you missed. Because I've actually given up on games, even though I'm like 3/4 of the way through them, for this exact reason. Because if I find out, like, oh, I fucked up some series of steps like 10 hours ago and now I can't get this thing, then I just feel defeated, honestly. And I just throw the game out. Like, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Right, and that's because Final Fantasy IX is in a series of games where when something like that happens, you do feel defeated. You do feel like you're missing out on something. And that's to Final Fantasy IX's fault, because even though you don't necessarily know those, you don't necessarily need that thing, because there are so many ways to make up for it, which I discovered towards later in the game, which made me completely feel stupid putting as much time into the Chocobo hot and cold game that I did, just because you can pretty much get everything that you need at the end of the game in the final dungeon, and it completely doesn't justify everything you do with the damn Chocobo stuff. What you find out is a lot of these items that are usually locked off in other Final Fantasies that you need to do extra shit for in other Final Fantasies, you can completely get through almost natural means, or find an equivalent of that almost negates the item that you could get through other means. Mm-hmm. Especially through the way that you level up your skills, because all skills are attached to other items that you can get. There's no way to really, I mean, certain skills, yes, are unique to certain items, but those skills aren't 100% necessary. They're just cool skills. So you don't necessarily need it to beat the game like in other Final Fantasies. And that's what makes it frustrating, because you're usually rewarded for going back to areas and finding things you didn't find. So when you're cut off from getting things, it's naturally frustrating. It's naturally defeating. And if you realize, if you got the strategy guide for this game way back in 2000, and you were pretty much shit out of luck too. Do you know about the strategy guide? Do you know what the Squaresoft did?
You mean about like having you go to a website instead of including the information in the actual book?
Yes. So you have to remember, yeah, this is like, it was released in 2000, and Final Fantasy XI was released in either 2001 or 2002, somewhere around there. But in any case, like, because they were gearing up for it, like Final Fantasy 9, 10, and 11 came out in very rapid succession, almost like 1, 2, and 3 did back in the NES, in Japan anyway. So like they were gearing up for Final Fantasy XI to come out. So they, of course, wanted more subscribers onto their Play Online service. So when they came out with the strategy guide for Final Fantasy IX, every single time you got to a boss, it would say something like, here's the boss. If you want to figure out how to defeat him, go to www.playonline.com and you can figure out what you can steal from them, what their weaknesses are, and this, that, and the other. It was terrible.
Yeah, because then at that point, you kind of feel like, why the fuck did I buy this book then?
Exactly. It's probably the worst strategy guide of all time. But that's going into it. Like, you're expecting stuff like Final Fantasy VII, where there's items that are hidden that you can't get back for a long time. Like, I remember, like, the Remu material in Materia in Final Fantasy VII at the Gold Saucer, that if you don't get it that time, it's going to be a while before you can get it again. But unless you know it's there, you're not going to know it's there. And Final Fantasy IX has a lot of those instances, at least initially, but until you realize, oh, I don't really need this shit, because there's a million opportunities to get it later. I don't know if that makes it more frustrating or less.
Well, so, but that's actually the thing, is that I think it's both, actually.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, like I said, I feel like maybe they realized that that was a pain in the ass. And so when IX came around, they decided to, you know, give us a little bit of leeway, and in that you can still get those items later on if you don't know how to get it early in the game. So on one hand, that's good. But then we're also talking about the 9th entry in a series. Well, you know, technically whatever, you know what I mean. But yeah, we're at FF9 for all intents and purposes. And if you've been playing any of these games up until that point, you've had 8 other games to have this sort of system ingrained in your head of, I cannot miss things. If I miss things, I will not be able to get them back. I must find all the things. And then, so to go into 9 with that same mindset, only to then find out that you put all that extra time and effort into finding those things early, and they just show up in a fucking shop 20 minutes later in a different town, that's actually also super irritating in its own way.
It is.
So I kind of, I suppose they're kind of a, it was a, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of scenario, because they were trying to improve it. But I think just the fact that they were so, the series was already so long in the tooth, and there was so much baggage coming along with it, that it was going to kind of suck a little bit one way or the other.
Especially when you look at how the game was set up, and I'll get more into that unless you want me to start now about kind of like my history with the game and what kind of went on with it.
I say I'll wrap up some of my other bullet point things.
Absolutely.
That I wanted to touch on, and then we can go into that. But some more things with the combat. So the trance system, right, is kind of a big deal or a big part of the game. I would actually argue it's not a huge deal, but
it's not a where, deal.
Well, yeah, where, you know, essentially like your character builds up this gauge over time and then you go into a trance mode where you get some new abilities and you're more powerful for a short period of time and et cetera, et cetera. So like on paper, that's cool. But the way that it actually plays out in the game is just like, most of the time, really inconvenient. It's actually kind of unpredictable about when it's going to proc for you. And when it does, at least in my experience, and I think based on some of my cursory searching around the internets, I don't think I'm the only one. These happen at like just the worst time. Like you'll be at the end of a battle and then suddenly you'll get a trance pop. And then, oh, by the way, that doesn't carry over. So if you got that and then the battle's over, it's just wasted.
Not to mention trances for everyone but Zidane and maybe Vivi are pretty much useless.
Yeah, they all kind of blow. Like you think they're going to be cool, but effectively they all kind of suck except for, yeah, Zidane, but that's just because he's OP anyway. I guess the other thing, so there's another system that's not combat related that's included in this game. It's called the active time event system, that I actually kind of really liked. So basically what happens is there are certain points in the game when you're wandering around an area, whether it's a town or a jungle or forest or what have you. Sometimes your characters will split up and go do different things concurrently. The way that they decided to handle that one was having this active time event system where it will pop up. And if you hit your select button on your controller, it'll give you a list of things that are currently happening right now with the characters you are not currently controlling. So then you can pop over and see usually a relatively short little like plot snippet of their own sort of like sub thread that's going on. And I thought that was kind of cool. It's an interesting way to kind of do that's like, you know, multi-threaded storytelling, without it being like super, intrusive. So I actually thought that worked pretty well. I don't know how you felt about it.
I have mixed feelings on it. First of all, I don't know what was first, if this happened first or if that happened with the Tales of series, because the Tales of series does something very similar to that, except it more does it with the people who are in your party. They have these discussions. You'll be walking around the world map or you'll be walking in a city and then it'll say like press select or something like that for an event, and you'll press it and then there'll be a discussion between characters within your party about extra plot details or extra character information that you'll get from your party. Now, I don't know if that happened in like Tales of Destiny or Tales of Phantasia, and Tales of Destiny 2, which I don't remember the original name of, because Tales of Destiny here in America was different than what it was in Japan. I'm not extraordinarily familiar with the linearity of or history of the Tales of series, even though I'm a fan of some of the games. I'm not a huge fan, though. But when it comes to it, because it comes down to it again, that some of these can be missable events. If you don't press select at the right time, you may miss some of these events, and there's no real way to make up and see them if you wanted to see them. Some of them are completely missable. And it's just kind of, I don't know what triggers whether or not I'm able to see it. Is it because I picked one event instead of the other one? Did I see this one when I wasn't supposed to see it, and I was supposed to see this one when I wasn't supposed to? And I think other games handled it better even before that, like with Final Fantasy VII, Final Fantasy VIII. If an event was happening off screen, it would automatically take you to that event and show it to you. Now, I understand that if you're trying, you have multiple characters in multiple parts of a town or city like Final Fantasy IX handles it, yeah, it's a little bit intrusive to just randomly stop a game and then show you a character without introducing a way to interrupt it yourself with the active time event. But I just, again, it felt like sometimes I was missing out on plot details or missing out on events just because maybe I missed an opportunity to press the select button or I chose the wrong option to see first, or I entered an area I wasn't supposed to enter, and so I couldn't see an event that was previously selectable. And that was kind of irritating. Even though the active time events were enjoyable, and they provided more for the plot and more was going on and provided some more detail, I still saw some flaws in it, and I didn't understand why they executed it the way they did.
No, I mean, I think that's fair. I guess the part that I liked about it is just, even though potentially they are missable, I think, well, this might be an ignorance is bliss scenario because I purposefully didn't look up anything as far as like strategy guide stuff regarding the active time events. So if I did miss something, I just don't know. So I feel like I'm better off that way. But I mean, the thing that I liked was just that it, like counter to how it was handled in some of the earlier games, though maybe it's just a thin veneer at best, I feel like it does give some agency to the player in that you are, even though it's literally just pressing a button and selecting from a list of things, it's kind of involving you a little bit more in the story, even though it's not like a choose your own adventure, like it's going to play out the same way regardless. It just, I guess it's that illusion of choice thing that I guess makes a little bit of a difference.
I can understand that. I think that's why it's a popular feature in the Tales series and why it has persisted. Because if people obviously didn't like it, it wouldn't continue in that series like it did.
Right.
So they definitely went with a thing that worked for a lot of people. And a lot of people apparently like it. I don't care for it either way. I'm more happy if I just see a random event as long as it's plot relevant. But these are kind of lesser significant plot points to just kind of add to the overall lore of the situation. So I can't complain too much. I just thought it was rather strange. And when I say like it's not a strategy guide thing, sometimes you'll see options that you can select from that are there. Mm-hmm. And then another active time event will come up, and one of the events that you may have wanted to select before isn't a selection anymore.
Yeah, I don't recall off the top of my head that I ever had that happen to me, but I certainly wouldn't rule that out.
Yeah. So I've kind of alluded to it. So in the brief history of, I kind of wrote it for more of a personal skew. So I got this game originally on the Japanese release. My father was traveling abroad. He went to Japan on business, and he came back with a copy of Final Fantasy IX. This was either the month of release or the month after. It was very, very close to release, and he saw it, and he got it, he brought it home. And he did that because he knew I had finagled a way to play imports on my PlayStation via GameShark and a piece of tape. If you don't know how to do that, look it up.
Tech.
It's great. I'm sure anyone who's in the import scene knows how it is. In any case, so I was really looking forward to Final Fantasy IX. So as I described it, you know, there was a time in the 90s where RPGs were extremely niche. They were a very, very, very small community. Video games had started to turn that corner, of course, where they were accepted. So, like, people played Mario, people played Contra, people played Tetris. You could talk about these things with people in school, and it wouldn't be, you know, terrible. And I'm trying to make it as brief as possible because I could go way more further in depth on this on a Final Fantasy VII episode, and which will be later. So in any case, RPGs were niche. Final Fantasy VII came out. All of a sudden, everyone loved Final Fantasy VII. Final Fantasy VII is the greatest RPG of all time, and anyone who says anything other than that doesn't know what they're talking about, and every RPG that was released before it was stupid. And pretty much everyone who had played an RPG before that was like, well, Final Fantasy VII is a really good game, but, you know, there's like these other games, and it was just like 12-year-old me felt that way. So anyway.
you're an RPG hipster. It's fine. You can.
I was an RPG hipster at 12. So Final Fantasy VII came out, and it wasn't a medieval setting, and I was like, well, where's my Final Fantasy? And then Final Fantasy VIII came out, and it also was in this postmodern setting. And it was kind of like, well, where's my Final Fantasy? And every single time.
This is not my Final Fantasy.
This is not my Final Fantasy. And all these other RPGs were coming out, and you'd be like, okay, cool. Now I have RPG friends because they like Final Fantasy VII. Try this RPG out. And it's like, well, this is stupid. And all sort of other slurs that aren't exactly acceptable in modern time and age. So Final Fantasy IX was supposed to be a return to grace. It was supposed to be a focus, as Sakaguchi indicates, it was supposed to be revisiting all of the previous Final Fantasies. So you have a lot of tracks and a lot of themes from previous Final Fantasies, like Dragoons come back. There's references to Final Fantasy II and music and in story, and that's Japanese too. Final Fantasy I, Final Fantasy VII. In fact, just like almost every Final Fantasy is represented in some sort of lore, object, or item. So it's definitely calling back to it. So the developers were very, very, very aware that there was a set of their fandom that wanted to return to the more traditional style of Final Fantasy.
Make Final Fantasy great again.
Yeah. I can't come up with an acronym. There's not enough vowels there. So
MAFA. MAFGA.
MFGA. MFGA.
MFGA. There you go. MFGA.
MFGA. I like that. MFGA. In any case, so when I say like I wanted to like Final Fantasy, when I say I wanted to like Final Fantasy IX, like that's an almost personal thing for like 15-year-old me. I really wanted to like it. I personally wanted to like it because I wanted to have the games that I fell in love with like Final Fantasy at the time, 1, 2, and 3, those games to me that defined the console RPG, and I felt like Final Fantasy 7 and Final Fantasy 8 were deviating from it, and I was like, Final Fantasy 9 is going to be so good, and Dragon Quest 7 is going to be so good, and this is what RPGs are meant to be, and this is what they should be, so I wanted to love it. And I didn't love it as much as I thought I could. I thought I would, and for a lot of the reasons, you know, me and Shannon already discussed. You know, the battle sequences were very slow. You constantly had to manage your inventory because of the synth system, so you never knew whether or not it was safe to sell anything because you didn't want to feel like you're going to miss out on any item later in the game that would devoid you of skills. Even though I liked that system because it reminded me of like Materia, and each character had a class again. So you had like Steiner was a knight and Zidane was a thief and Salamander or Amaranth was a monk, and you had a summoner and a white mage and a black mage and a dragoon. And it's like, okay, cool. Everyone is specialized again. Like they were, and this is a cool return to form, but there's so many things that are just, I'm juggling too much crap that I don't care about or want to care about, and the story doesn't necessarily get good until the end of Disc 3 or middle of Disc 3, and I'm like, oh, okay, now this makes sense, now this is having fun, and I think me and Shane are going to disagree with that when we start talking about the plot, but that's what I'm going with from Final Fantasy IX. Is that so many people wanted to love this game. And when it came out in 2000, a lot of the people that were supposed to love this game didn't love this game. Much like a lot of the people that were supposed to love Wind Waker didn't love Wind Waker because they were so short-sighted on what the game was. You had super deformed characters again, which people said they wanted, but then they looked at it and they're like, well, we don't want this. And you had all these old battle system things that people said they wanted, and they got it. And they're like, well, I'm not sure if we really want this. And then when we go back, they're like, okay, yeah, it was fine. But and we do like it, but we didn't know what we were expecting. That fan base that was vocal and wanted that old Final Fantasy. So I'm like I'm saying, 15-year-old me, 12-year-old me was stupid, naive, and didn't know what to expect. I'm not saying that Final Fantasy VII is better than IX. I don't think it is. I think IX is better than VII. But I think that the expectations going into IX at the time were so unrealistic, and they were so unfair to the rest of the series that I think it really put a bad taste in a lot of the fan base's mouth. That was the fan of like VII and VIII, as opposed to the people who had the niche fan base that was there for six and before.
Yeah, and that also reminds me of this is something that continually happens even today. It reminds me of the WoW Classic servers that are coming finally. For the longest time, World of Warcraft fans kept crying about how they wanted Blizzard to support vanilla servers where it would just be basically how the game was when it first released in 2004. So you could go back and roll a character and just play from 0 to 60 and do all of the original content the way that it was played back then. And people clamor for this shit. And honestly, for the longest time, Blizzard was putting that off because they were basically just telling them, like, listen, guys, you think you want this, but we're telling you, you really don't. And of course, gamers being the way that we are sometimes, they were just like, no, fuck you, Blizzard. You don't know me. Like, that's what we want. And those nostalgia glasses are a serious thing. Because I guarantee that it's going to be the same thing that happened kind of with this scenario that Chris was just talking about, that when those classic servers come online and people start rolling characters, they're going to be into it for about a month, maybe, and then realize how many quality of life improvements occurred from 2004 and probably drop it because things aren't the way that you remember them. They never are.
Yes, I agree with that. But on that same point, I still think that like 6 is better than 7 and 4 is better than 7 and 9 is better than 7. Even after going back and replaying it, it's not so much that I think that they aren't the way you remember them, but they aren't as good as you remember them. They're still good. They're still great. They're still fantastic experiences. But when you have an experience that's so jarring from the original experience you had, you do start to get those rose-tinted glasses, as you said, and you start romanticizing those experiences for more than what they were. So when you probably do revisit it, or you have these lofty expectations of what it is, it doesn't compare to what you experienced until you go in with complete blinders on and you just experience it as it is, as opposed to as you remember it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you and I are actually more on the same page on this than
I think.
It's not that like original World of Warcraft was bad. It was amazing. It's just that going back and experiencing those systems now, to your point, like where FF9 kind of brought back some of the more archaic systems from older games rather than following the same vein of like 7 and 8. I just feel like there's a parallel there that people are going to go back into these classic WoW servers and realize that like, oh, right, I didn't actually like standing outside of a dungeon spamming the Looking for Group channel for a half an hour to find a tank. Yeah, no, that dungeon finder system's actually pretty cool. You know, just shit like that.
It didn't help that Final Fantasy VIII was also a massive turd. And I understand that also game that has its fans. So when you go from 7, which I still say is a good game, a very good game.
Meh.
Final Fantasy VIII is not. It is not a good game. And that's my opinion. Whatever, my opinion's like an asshole, and you have one too. But Final Fantasy VIII is not a good game. And I think when people played Final Fantasy IX, they were expecting a huge leap in quality, and what they got was a very, very, very good game. But I don't think it lived up to the expectations that a lot of people did back in 2000. I think people are now like appreciating it like they did with Wind Waker. Okay, yeah, it's a really good game. It has its flaws, but it's a very good game. But let's get to the plot. So what did you think about the plot?
Yeah. We'll touch on this one fairly briefly because I know that we're kind of running up on our time now. So I'm not sure that you and I are going to disagree wholly on this. But I will say, and this is almost verbatim from the notes that I wrote for the show today, the plot basically right around to Chris's earlier point, somewhere mid disc 3 or so, kind of takes this like really hard left turn into Crazy Town.
Spoilers for an almost 20-year-old game, but spoilers.
Well, so normally I'd say, well, fuck off, you should have played it by now. But to be fair, it also did just get released on the Switch. So I guess there might be some people that are coming into it new. So yes, plot spoilers. So if you don't want to hear this, skip ahead a little bit. Or I don't know, man, turn the damn episode off. I guess we're close to being done. But anyway, so the up until that point, this game is basically kind of honestly a little milquetoast. It's kind of boring in that it's this really kind of rote plot about a couple of medieval nations that are potentially going to war with each other. Like, there was this tenuous peace, and then, like, one side decides that they want power and blah, blah, blah. And so there's a princess and she escapes, and it's like political intrigue and stuff like that, but it's not anything like crazy or really fantastical. There's a couple things that get introduced, like, in very small kind of doses along the way up until the major detour. Like, you know, the black mages that Kuja's using and stuff like that, which seems a little weird. But then you hit a point, and Chris, you can go into this one a little bit more in depth on exactly what occurs here, but you hit a plot point where then suddenly it's like, oh, right, I'm playing a Sakaguchi game. How could I have forgotten? Let's all go into crazy land. And you get there via a portal, I think, actually.
It you do, and it makes sense if you've played Final Fantasy IV and you were expecting a Final Fantasy IV type kind of plot twist. In fact, a lot of this game does mirror a lot of what happens with Final Fantasy IV. So you have two planets, you have Terra and you have Gaia, and essentially Kuja, who is one of the main antagonists of the game, but the ending fucks it up. But you have you have Kuja, who is your main antagonist, who is sent to Earth to essentially kill people so more souls are generated, so that Gaia, which is a planet that relies on the regeneration of souls so it can become a new planet, can come back to prominence. So they're killing...
You mean Terra, right?
No, Gaia... I don't even know. Gaia is the planet you're on, right? Terra is the one that Garland is part of.
Terra is the one that is dying and that Garland's okay. part of.
Yeah. Okay, so Garland's on Terra. So Garland is this robot who is kind of like a shepherd of souls, and he's trying to make sure all these souls go into bodies. So he's created these fake bodies to run around, you know, temporary Terra until Gaia has completely been devoid of souls so he can reload, or something like that. Something similar to that.
He's basically making these soulless husks called genomes that are their sole purpose. They're sentient, though. But their sole purpose, unbeknownst to them, is to become vessels for these souls of Gaians that have passed on or something. Or I guess either that or no, actually it's the Terrans. The Terrans that have passed on or something like that. Those souls get reinserted into these genomes so that they can be sort of like born again and they can take over Gaia as their new planet. Whereas like the Gaian souls actually get turned into the mist, which the living people of Gaia have been using to power their advanced technology and ships, which is kind of fucked up.
Which, if you've noticed in Final Fantasy lore with 7, we have Mako energy, which is essentially energy of the dead. And now you have Mist, which is energy of the dead, using to power people. Sakaguchi probably doesn't have a very high opinion on fossil fuels.
probably not.
But in any case, like, I liked the plot from the case that, and it ties into the aesthetics. And I'll say this very briefly, or briefly as I can, because it's complicated as shit. So I like it because you have Kuja, who's making the black mages, who are essentially vessels and puppets. They are essentially, and this is where the plot kind of deviates other than the milquetoast, as you said, kind of plot point, because everything that's around Vivi is not milquetoast. It is very questioning, what is the meaning of identity? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to be alive? And what does it mean to have a soul? And these are a lot of things that you experience in the Black Mage Village through the discussions that Vivi has with them. What is the purpose of life? What is the meaning of life? And these are the questions that are brought up. And the entire party, and especially Zidane, our protagonist, is just trying to do whatever he can to encourage Vivi, and is kind of like, you know, it's okay. You're not some sort of puppet. You're not a vessel. You're a living being. And then Zidane goes to Terra, and he finds out he's one of these genomes. Shocker. So there's your spoiler. Another spoiler. So Zidane is pretty much the same thing that Vivi is. And that's like, oh, wow. Like, this is really, to me, it was like, wow, this is really cool. This is tying in previous plot points. This is tying in previous plot threads. And what I mean by it goes by the aesthetics is, this is something we've made joke before on this podcast, that everyone kind of looks like a doll. Everyone kind of looks like a like the Labyrinth character from a Jim Henson, like a Muppet, like a puppet. And I always used to make fun of it. It's like all these things kind of look stupid. And then I don't know if it was intentional on the design or developers or Sakaguchi or whoever. I don't know. But when I really started thinking about it, and this might be on my harebrained scheme, is that the characters look like puppets and dolls, because the plot is pretty much saying that everyone in this plot are puppets and dolls to another purpose. If you think about how Vivi
is deep.
If you think about how Vivi, they're a bunch of puppets and dolls. If you think about how Zidane and his people are, they're puppets and dolls. What is a life? What is a puppet? What is a doll? Are we living beings? Or you know what I'm saying?
What is a man?
What is a man? A miserable pile of secrets. but I, like, that's how I started viewing the plot. Like, holy shit. Like, maybe this aesthetic that was said to be super deformed to be a throwback to the 16 and 8-bit era, maybe the reason they look like dolls is to back up the plot point that they're trying to make. And I was like, I don't know if that's what they were trying to do, but to me, that's kind of what I got from it, because they do look like dolls.
Either that's a really interesting revelation that you've had about that, or you are giving the developers too much credit. One of the two.
Maybe both.
possibly. But no, that is a cool theory, though. I do like that. And like I said earlier, I don't think we necessarily disagree so much. It's not that I disliked the plot. It's just, it was kind of one of those moments where I'm just like, all right, Sakaguchi, there you are. I knew you were here somewhere. And there it is. Because, like, up until that point, it was all pretty straightforward, right? And if you listened to our Kingdom Hearts episode we did a few times back, you knew that Sakaguchi was more or less the reason that the plot for Kingdom Hearts got as weird and convoluted as it ended up getting, thanks to, like, a passing suggestion that he had to Nomura early on in development. But, just thinking about that, there's some interesting parallels in the plot points of the Kingdom Hearts universe and FF9 in particular, with like the creation of like sentient, like soulless bodies for like souls to be placed in and things like that, because that same exact shit happens in Kingdom Hearts with like replicas and people's hearts and things like that. So interesting parallel there.
Oh, by the way, Vivi dies, and there's some guy who shows up that says hi at the end of the game, and you have to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's pretty much how they describe it. Hi, I'm a guy whose name is involved with death. Kill me. And then you get to the end of the game, and it's really happy, and it's insinuated Vivi is dead.
Yes, and then Zidane and Garnet, or you may know her as Dagger if you didn't pick your own nickname. have a happily ever after, supposedly, I guess.
That's such a stupid naming convention, too. Like, I want my name to be what you carry in your pocket. Penis.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that that's just the first thing he came up with. I think that speaks to the level of intelligence of the character. He's just like, I don't know, what do you got on you? All right, your pocket watch. Congratulations. God.
It's so stupid, because you know her name is not that name. It's like in Chrono Trigger when you find out that Marl's name isn't Marl, and you're going through the entire game and everyone's calling her Marl or Marley, and you know she's not Marley. Like, you know she's not Dagger. You know who she is. Knock that shit off. Like, stop.
But she had to take on a pseudonym to hide her identity while traveling, Chris. It was an important plot point.
Until what point?
I don't know, until they decided to start doing it.
Again, I have to say, look, I love this game. Disc 3 is where it really takes off. So if you don't like Disc 1 through 2, I completely understand. Disc 3 makes up for it, and it pays off. I guess we're going into, is this game worth it? So I'm just going to go there because we're running along the two. So there, that's my point. This game is worth it if you've never played it before, because each subsequent playthrough, at least for me, is harder and harder to get through the first half of the game because it's so bland. It's so cliche, with the exception of a few things. And if you're going for plot points, you already know the plot. There's not much that's going to deviate in gameplay. And then once you get to that disc 3, that's when the game picks up. That's when it becomes more interesting. That's when you're going to have your better time. So does it hold up? Sure. Get the Switch version. It's portable. If you never played it before, enjoy it. It's one of the better Final Fantasies. Don't worry too much about item management if that concerns you and your OCD, like most RPG players are. Just enjoy it, have a good time, and play it, and you won't be disappointed.
Yeah. No, I mean, I guess that sums it up pretty well. I would definitely recommend getting the Switch version, or I think, was that a multi-platform release or was it just Switch? I don't remember now, but anyway.
Switch, PS4, Steam, and Android.
Oh, see, there you go. Well, maybe not Android, but any of the other platforms, I would definitely do that. But yeah, it comes with the very strong caveat that if you can survive the first like two discs, and I suppose if you're buying the new version, disc is meaningless to you. But let's just say, what would you say, like the first half, probably?
The first 20 hours.
Okay, there you go. So with the strong caveat that if you can survive the first 20 hours of kind of boring content and a few like funny and interesting character moments along the way, but largely kind of drags, then sure, try it out. I mean, it's not a bad game by any means, but it sure takes its time getting to where it needs to go. That's for sure.
And it loves gimmicks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it loves gimmicks. Also, Beatrix is best waifu. I just want to throw that out there.
I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I can't. You're not saying it was a queen. What's her face? That's not your boo?
Oh, my God, dude. Like, it was bad enough with the queen character Braun. Models. But when you see Queen Braun in like the first like CG cutscene that she's in, you're just like, oh, ooh, that's, I don't know what that is. It's technically a woman, but damn.
I think Kuja is best waifu.
That I don't really have a lot to argue about that one. Maybe he'll take runner up. He's honorary second place.
Yeah, he's a pretty guy, but
sure is.
And one last fun fact: if you really want to have fun, the final boss battle you have at Kuja, play that song and then play it in comparison to the Chrono Trigger dinosaur dungeon that you play in 65 million BC. When the dungeon that you go to before Labos lands, and they are almost the exact same song.
Mm, yeah, actually, I seem to recall that I think the composer actually got a little bit of shit for that, Umatsu.
He doesn't care. He's rich.
I mean, yeah, that's true. He's taking all of that criticism in stride while he's cashing all those sweet royalty checks. But
and he's also had to write over like 5,000 songs, so I don't think he really cares at all.
Yeah, he's just like, you know what? Fuck off. I've run out of ideas.
Anyway, let's wrap this up.
Yeah. So, all right. You know, actually, to be fair, I think we had more to talk about on this one than I actually thought we would. So that was good. I'm happy with how that played out.
And we could have gone longer.
We could have, yeah. So as we are wont to do usually, we can kind of plug some of the places that you can get in touch with us if you'd like to do that. We are on all of the major social media platforms, but predominantly you can probably have the best time finding us on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, probably one of those three. If it's Twitter, it's probably going to be Chris answering you. If it's Instagram, it's definitely me, and Facebook is a crapshoot. So there you go. Choose your fighter. And outside of that, you can also reach us by email at podcast@retrohangover.com. And of course, you can just simply go to retrohangover.com if you would like to visit and leave a comment there. Chris, do we have any shout outs we want to throw out this week?
Not in particular, but I will say that I'm not going to shout it out because we do have a more than likely special guest appearance for our next episode. So
yes.
Normally I would shout this person out, but we'll keep it a little bit of a mystery. They know who they are. So look forward to that in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, we gotta keep an air of mystery. So, okay. I guess that works.
I like mystery.
Yeah. All right. Well, in that case, until next time,
play with your joysticks, but not with this game, on an analog, massively phallic controller. And finally, we have done the Final Fantasy IX episode. Thank you, Shane. It's there.
You're welcome.